Hello and welcome to another Ometown Daily News Show. I am Mayor Watt. That is Ometown.com. I stream here on Twitch, the Ometown Daily News Show, which is obviously a daily news show that is aggregated into existence through Ometown.com's aggregator. That throws things into news into six main categories: create, news, education, entertainment, social, and technology. And from there into 50 channels that I hope to bring to Twitch and or YouTube and podcast. So go over to Apple or Google or wherever Spotify and others have Ometown as a podcast, or you can go over to YouTube and subscribe and like and follow over here on Twitch and over on YouTube. YouTube is a long-term storage. And I'm not partner with Twitch, so I have limited storage here. So at any rate, today's episode is for June 13th, 2022. It's episode 164. I started this 164 days ago, and I'm looking forward to interacting with more people and chatting about the news and expanding. And in that, I am planning on ending today's stream in about an hour and then moving on to talking about Starfield for a little bit, basically streaming the trailer and talking about elements within it. Immediately after that, I will be hosting a new show within the confines of the Continuity Report, which is a channel here. Under social, it's in this right here, a channel called The Continuity Report, and I will be hosting a revisiting of the TV show Friends. It's almost 30 years ago that Friends launched, and I haven't watched it since it streamed, or since it launched on TV some nearly 30 years ago. And I've always wanted to host a series of shows talking about TV shows, and something really interesting about Friends is that it was basically, it wasn't in any real trouble in terms of popularity. It was extremely popular for most of its run, all the way up to the end where the decision was to pull Friends, because Friends ultimately, I guess you move on as you grow, and the writers and actors came to the conclusion that at some point, Friends stop being your focus of family and you start having a family. And I've always called it as jumping the shark, like everybody else has, refers to jumping the shark when something really stupendous happens, just kind of over the top antics. But for me, it's largely, if in your sitcom or show somebody ends up having a baby, and it isn't just a temporary actor that comes in to do a part, that pretty much signals the end of the show. Much like what I describe as, if you go to visit a store that seemingly is in trouble and suddenly they are putting little pop-up tables out front and they're selling tchotchkes and other what most people would refer to as junk, you can pretty much count on that business closing or going bankrupt and being acquired and pivoted in some way. And even then they probably don't recover. But anyway, that never really happened with Friends. It kept on traveling, and then they transitioned into moving on to where family becomes the most important thing in somebody's life and not necessarily their friends. With that in mind, it's going to be a 1-2-3 kind of a thing. So I'm going to do today's Ometown Daily News Show. Then I'm going to do the Starfield discussion, which is really just my interpretation of what's coming out of that game. And then I will do the show about Friends, which I'm going to be referring to as I Need Friends. And I will also be within the envelope of the continuity report, I will be doing the same with episodes of Strange New Star Trek, Strange New Worlds. Different days, different times, but all the same, it will be streamed in a different format where it's basically going to be me and a timer or something that will allow us to sync our shows because I can't stream the actual video and I'm not really sure even about the audio. I will be streaming bits of the audio, not all of it, and talking about the show live right here on Twitch, and then it's going to get turned into a podcast separate from Hometown Daily News Show. Okay, with that in mind, let's move on. The first article that I'm going to be talking about today is Coinbase plunges more than 20% as Bitcoin dives. Let me throw that in chat. And let me see something real quick. I wanted to. Yeah, so this comes on the heels of yesterday's discussion. It was brief, drawing attention to the fact that Coinbase's CEO said, if you don't like it here, quit. And then today we see Coinbase makes a commission when people buy and sell cryptocurrencies. Monday's move appears to be tied to a tumbling crypto market. Let's click that link and takes us over to CNBC. It says the crypto exchange platform makes a commission when people buy or trade cryptocurrency, but Bitcoin, pardon me one second, Bitcoin has been plunging. In fact, let me make sure that I have the correct number. So Bitcoin has dropped today $3,850, rounding up $51, $3,851. And this is going to impact negatively impact trading platforms. But this is still the same CEO that basically told people, quit. If you don't like it, quit. If you don't like us, quit. If you don't like the ecosystem, quit. If you don't like the culture, quit. If you don't like your job here, quit. And that to me builds a culture of my way or the highway, which is fine. That's what a company can do if you want it that way. And you don't want to take any feedback from the public or your employees. And that's the culture that is brewed. So just count on the fact that if you are unhappy, your only option really is to quit. Even if you voice your opinion, apparently. So it says Coinbase's stock is down 76% year to date after first quarter earnings in May showed revenue fell 27% year over year as usage declined. The company said, we believe these market conditions are not permanent and we remain focused on the long term. Yeah. So, I will just reiterate, the only reason why anybody is in crypto right now is because it's pegged to a dollar and the perceived value and fear of missing out. If this had actual value to it, people would be buying and selling things in Bitcoin and not with the perceived value of Bitcoin translated into US dollars, if you understand what I'm saying. The reason why people are interested in pretty much anything is because it is pegged to the US dollar. So that currency is what's giving value to Bitcoin, not the inherent value of Bitcoin. It's a subtle but distinct difference between the value of a dollar and the goods and services that you are procuring with that dollar. Again, the only reason why Bitcoin is valued at what it is because people are making US dollars or their domestic currency, whatever it might be, wherein Bitcoin is pegged to that currency, typically US dollars. And people are trading and converting their domestic currency into US dollars, buying Bitcoin, and then translating it back when the timing is right. Well, now it's dropped close to $4,000 in a day. That volatility, it's untenable as a currency. Let's continue on. The next article is in the Mobile Channel. K-12 workers most likely to say that they're burned out, according to a Gallup poll. Now, this article is over at The Hill. I'll just go over to it. That way we can get through all of the articles today. And this is an article. Oh, you know what? Forgive me. The last article about Coinbase plunging more than 14% was written by Todd Hasselton over at CNBC. This next article, the one about K-12 workers most likely to say they're burned out, is a Gallup poll, but it was written about at The Hill by Rachel Scully. And I can imagine that K-12 workers are going to get burned out because they have to jump through a lot of hoops here in the United States. A lot of paperwork, a lot of monitoring. For the most part, you know, some, like anything, there is a gamut of performance. Some people struggle with it because they hate it and find it tedious, and others just do it and move on. But it says 44% of K-12 workers surveyed said they always or very often feel burned out, with college or university workers following not far behind at 35%. Within the K-12 employees, 52% of teachers reported feeling burned out. Yeah. Interesting. It says the new data shows educators identify among the most burned out in, of all the industries. Yeah, I can imagine. And the Gallup poll was conducted from February 3rd to 14th with a total of 12,319 respondents, and the margin of error was plus or minus 4%. Which, I don't know, that's fine, I guess. I'm not sure what else is really what to say about this. You know, female K-12 workers, especially teachers, are respondents who say they are most burned out at 47% and 55% respectively. Yeah. And teachers really do have to deal with a lot. And there's a lot of external influence on that burnout, because the parents come in and complain to the teachers for one reason or another. And depending on what the political discourse is of a of an assignment, it ends up being worse. And something as simple as a word problem that involves anything that somebody might take exception to. If they bring home the assignment and the parent reads it, then all hell breaks loose. So I can see why people get burned out. Let's continue on to the next article. Again, these are all going to be in the show notes. You can follow the link through Hometown to the various sources that I aggregate from. The next article is over in Hatch Ideas channel. EV startup Electric Last Mile Solutions plans to declare bankruptcy a year after going public. The Michigan-based startup will move to liquidate less than a year after it went public, which is really a shock. Whatever was going on is troubling to me, at least. I'm not an investor in this. I have no dog in the hunt, but I don't like the idea of a business going bankrupt a year after its IPO. Electric Last Mile Solutions said it will liquidate its assets via Chapter 7 bankruptcy process. Elms, as it's known, has been unable to secure financing since its founder and CEO departed in February after an investigation found the company's financial statements to be unreliable. And that is just deadly. Its assets are going to be sold at a bargain. So let's see here. And I wouldn't be surprised. Oh, it's a SPAC. Interesting. The company is the first of those post-SPAC EV makers to say that it will declare bankruptcy. So basically, Elm's public offering in late June 2021 came amid a wave of SPAC deals that took EV makers public. And this is basically an organization that is created to seek out an investment location. And they're not bound by certain investor obligations. They basically have a bank of money and they can go out and find somebody and groom them into IPO. The IPO solidifies that investment that equity into some business process, whatever it might be. It could be EVs or it could be widgets. Doesn't matter what it is. And then that money goes into the business and is meted out to the various stakeholders where and when appropriate. So they have to hold on to their shares until they can start selling them. And it really depends on how long those are frozen. Once it's all vested, though, then they can start selling it. But I see a lot of this kind of, this is a lot of money chasing after unicorn after unicorn, which is never going to be found. A lot of this EV stuff is kind of shooting for the moon, but if they don't aim right, then they're lost. And in the face of Tesla and SpaceX and billionaires in the channel, this is, it's grasping at straws. So as long as the business can develop something, IPO, everybody gets a piece of the action and then lives long enough, the runway is long enough to get a product out into the market, then the people that did the SPAC could start selling their shares and moving on, recovering their costs, recovering their investment, and hopefully a significant multiple of that investment. We'll see what happens with SPACs. This is basically the embodiment of somebody coming up with something arcane that allows them to exploit something. And it's kind of like this push of capitalism to the edge of what's reasonable. And this volatility is based entirely on that. All of greedflation, all of the futures and stuff like that, all of that is... even like the mortgages where it's sold, your mortgage doesn't exist as a single thing, depending on the organization you got your mortgage from. It gets chopped into tranches and sold in levels of risk to people who don't mind. They accept the level of risk because what they're ending up doing is selling off a piece that's at high risk and taking less money than the total amount of that tranche of mortgage or whatever investment it is. So it's all sliced up and they sell off risk, and that risk gets converted into a valuation, and that valuation gets paid to the people that are doing the sale. Well, your mortgage doesn't exist as a single entity anymore. It's all broken up into this. On paper, it's one thing, but all of the money is not going to the same single thing. Regardless of that, all that is about mitigation of risk for the people that originally sold you your mortgage. Because as time goes on, maybe they don't trust that you'll be able to pay your full mortgage off or whatever it is. Again, whatever it is. And the same thing happens with unpaid bills, like at doctor's offices or something like that. It gets sold to a bill collector at a discounted rate just so that the people don't have to worry about chasing down a $20 copay or something like that. The reason why I bring all of that up is, like I said, in the middle of that little tirade, is that it's all about really getting their money so that they don't have to worry about you anymore, even if it is less money, and mitigating the risk. And when you push it further and further and further, it's really just, it's not really enabling anything other than profiting off of what should never have happened in the first place. And this is what happened with the mortgages back in 2008. Tons of risk were taken by companies, and instead of the companies getting their hands slapped by the collapse based on that extended risk, tax dollars, taxpayers paid to save them. And then instead of letting those businesses close and everybody who was involved with it having to deal with that reputational slap, they they were saved. They started paying it all back, but they raised the rates and people have to start paying more money than they would have normally because the risk would have been stopped in the future. Well, the risk is still there. And now we're back 2.5 years of pandemic. And we're now paying $5 on average here in the States for gasoline alone. And that's all greedflation because so much money's in the system. The people that produce have the ability to say, well, we want more money, even though they don't need more money. There just happens to be more money in the system. The price for a loaf of bread didn't need to increase because bread was still being produced at the same level and the same costs and everything, right? But the moment that gas went through the roof, and if you look at the history of oil, the volatility of oil after futures trading and after investment in oil was possible in the early 60s, that is when you see the volatility and the market spike for oil and gas. But people don't want to look back. They just want the profit and they don't care about the damage that was done to the economy. Let's continue on because I will just soapbox about this. So the next article, it's decidedly a business-centric day, I guess. I do have game stuff later on, but this next article is about the fastest growing entry-level jobs. So the class of 2022 is graduating into a strong job market. Yeah, I don't think so. Yet some industries and jobs are hotter than others. This is a CNBC article by Michelle Fox. And so the fastest growing job entry-level jobs is sales development representative, which is basically a salesperson. A business development representative where you go out and you find customers. It's different than sales. Talent acquisition specialist. That's an ultra niche HR related job. You're basically a talent scout and you try and get people that fit a particular niche. There are some companies out there where they actually locate people and groom them for a position because they have shown some type of talent. And then, companies hire them from these talent scouts, marketing coordinator, data analyst, depending on where you are, data analyst is a huge business, a huge opportunity. Financial analyst, I'd be a little leery of that one. Legal assistant, true. Additional strata are being formed within the legal system. So you'd be surprised how much a paralegal does for an attorney. And it's kind of like a nurse or medical assistant and a doctor. They do the brunt of the work and due diligence and then provide it to an attorney. The attorney reviews it to make sure that they agree with it or if they have any other wisdom or experience that might add to it. And then they sign off on it. And if you're really good, then you've got some job security, but you take the hit when things go wrong and you don't get public kudos for all of the benefit that you do. So don't think that, as a legal assistant, you are ending up in like the Johnny Depp trial and getting great public, call outs as to doing great things for the firm. Inside sales representative, operational specialist, which I'd have to look at what that even is, and barista. Okay. That's an interesting one to throw in there. So the fastest growing industries for entry-level talent in 2021 is staffing and recruiting, hospitality, healthcare and biotech, legal services, tech and IT services. Tech and IT, there will always be more jobs for tech and IT. You always need people to build stuff, run cables, configure systems. Legal services, it's still arcane at the upper level. You still have to go to law school to become an attorney. You have to pass the bar for your state. There's a lot of hoops that you have to go through, and law school is not cheap, and it isn't easy. And what's really interesting is that you really don't learn how to do much in law school. What you learn is how to think like an attorney, and you get groomed into thinking like you should if you're going to go into a firm or start your own. But all of the paperwork and all of the stuff, the where the rubber hits the road kind of stuff, you learn in the firm. Yet law school and good law schools are extremely expensive. And most of that's all about, you know, pushing you and social networking. So good luck if you're going to go into the legal profession. And there's more over at this article there on CNBC. Follow the link and you'll go through Ohmtown over to CNBC. The next article is in the Daily News Show. Plastic from old trucks becomes graphene for new cars. The average SUV contains up to 350 kilograms or almost 1,000 pounds of plastic that could sit in a landfill for centuries, but the recycling process reported in the journal Communications Engineering. The goal of the project was to reuse that graphene to make enhanced polyurethane foam for new vehicles. Tests showed the graphene-infused foam had 34% increase in tensile strength and 25% increase in low-frequency noise absorption. That's with only 0.1% by weight or less of graphene. So let's click the link. It'll take us over to futurity.org and an article by Mike Williams Rice. So let's see what else is in here. When the new car is old, the foam can be flashed into graphene again. Quote, Ford sent us 10 pounds of mixed plastic waste from a vehicle shredding facility, says James Tour, chair in chemistry and a professor of material science and nanoengineering at Rice University. Quote, it was muddy and wet. We flashed it, sent the graphene back to Ford. They put it into new foam composites, and it did everything it was supposed to do. Then they sent us the new composites, and we flashed those and turned them back into graphene. It's a great example of circular recycling. It's great. So, flash jewel heating. Flash jewel heating to make graphene, introduced by the Tour Lab in 2020, packs mixed ground plastic and a coke additive for conductivity between electrodes in a tube and blasts it with high voltage. The sudden intense heat, up to nearly 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, vaporizes other elements and leaves behind easy to solubilize turbostratic graphene. So flash heating offers significant environmental benefits as the process does not require solvents and uses a minimum of energy to produce graphene. I'm curious about the exhaust of this. The lab flashed the powder in two steps first under low voltage and then under high current in a heater that graduate student and lead author Kevin Weiss custom designed for the experiment. Neat. Well, that's great. If it makes it stronger and it is circular recycling, then it's hard to really complain about it. But really, what is the exhaust of this? I'd have to look around. Polyurethane is not something that is fun to mess with in terms of exhaust. So let's continue on to the next article. It's in Hatch Ideas. And China is testing 3.5 million Beijing residents after a ferocious, quote unquote, ferocious COVID outbreak just days after easing restrictions on nightlife. Let's see, around 10,000 close contacts of people who visited the bar have been locked down at home. The outbreak occurred soon after Beijing lifted social distancing rules last week. 3.5 million residents of China's capital, Beijing, are being tested. And it's not a voluntary thing. You got to get your butt tested. They've been linked to the Heaven Supermarket Bar, a popular nightlife venue and liquor supermarket in the central Beijing district of Chaoyang. Wow, 10,000 cases in an overnight event. This is an article over at businessinsider.com by Rosie Bradbury. Let's see. I'm trying to find more in this article. Yeah, they have a zero COVID mandate, and some of the things that I've seen, like people being chained into their house, like locking the door so they can't open it, and it's opened outside only to provide resources, stuff, supplies. Millions of residents of Shanghai, a commercial epicenter of China, were again placed under strict lockdown measures over the weekend after a cluster was linked to a popular beauty salon. Wow. Okay. So let's continue on to the next article. Seven tequila cocktails, perfect for outdoor summer sipping. Yes, it is only Monday, folks, but it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and the weekend is just beginning for some of those who are on summer break and not going to school and might be able to take a vacation. So anytime's a good time if you're in the right time to have a drink. So I have not had a drink in somewhere around 90 days. I'm actually beyond 90 days, but I don't remember anymore the exact time. I'd have to go and look at my I have a date that I don't recall right now, but anyway, so I haven't had a drink and I haven't had any added sugar. I've actually fallen off the wagon there for with the sugar a little bit, and so I was the reason why I was doing it was I wanted to see what the impact was on me personally, in regards to blood sugar and LDL and HDL and whatnot, right? So my oh my gosh, I just forgot what the thing is. Anyway, so I dropped 33% in 90 days, and the only thing that I really did was I stopped drinking. At one point, I started drinking like a drink a night. One drink a night, like a little, what is referred to as a finger or two fingers of spirits, so some alcohol, and not a beer or anything. I wasn't really drinking a beer, but it would be one drink a night, and so I cut it out entirely, and I stopped eating candy. I like candy, and my LDL dropped 33%, and all I did was protein whey protein drinks and Metamucil, which is fiber. Those two things alone. I wasn't taking any medication, at least not for cholesterol, and I was taking vitamin D and vitamin E. I need to get vitamin B going, but at any rate, an amazing transition in only 90 days. So if you have high cholesterol, I'm not a medical expert. You'd have to talk to your doctor if you want to. I think that you should do this just to see, get some blood work done, and then 90 days later, get your blood work done and see what the empirical difference is for you. Because I can say for me, it dropped 33%. And that percentage is different for everybody. Okay. So my cholesterol level was high, dramatically high, some would say. And, but no other tests were really bad. Nothing else was saying that I had anything going on. And so I did this on a whim, and I still have to talk to my doctor about it. So that would be interesting. So anyway, back to the show. Seven tequila cocktails, perfect for outdoor. Don't drink all of them, is what I'm saying. Just you can sip. Don't just go to town on all of these drinks all at once. Then you have a drinking problem. So this is an article over at vinepair.com by Clay Dillo. And the photograph is by Nick Johnson, and it basically has Don Julio tequila and somebody sitting out like a picnic. It's a very nice picture. And they have all the right ingredients. They're squeezing their lime into their drink, and they got their tequila, and that's always good when you put some lime on the rim. And those, I think I have those glasses. Anyway, Turmericana, merging sweet, earthy, spicy, and citrus flavors. The Turmericana provides more depth of flavor than its simple construction might suggest. So it just has tequila and turmeric and honey and lime juice. Oh, and a lime wheel. It says for turmeric salt, ground turmeric, sea salt, lime wedge. Añejo spicy margarita has tequila. And they're talking about Don Julio. So I don't know if this is supported by Don Julio, this, if this article is referring, like paid for, like an ad, you know. Let me see in the article. Yeah, I don't know. But it looks like Don Julio is very well engaged in this article. Añejo spicy margarita has orange liqueur, lime syrup, simple syrup, chipotle chili powder. Pardon me one second. For those interested, by the way, the January 6th hearings are underway right now here in the United States. Just do a search on YouTube and you'll find the broadcast. Rose Quartz is Don Julio Blanco tequila and sparkling water and rose water. That's probably a very light drink. By the time you taste the tequila, you're probably three sheets to the wind. Blood Orange Paloma. And you can imagine it has blood orange sparkling water and lime wedges and your choice of tequila. But it says Don Julio on it. Puesta del Sol, a more savory take on the famed tequila sunrise. The Puesta del Sol trades the sugary sweetness of grenadine for the muted earthiness of turmeric. And wow, they are really on the ball with this turmeric. They want that. It's like, it must be push the turmeric week. And Don Julio and Añejo Old Fashioned, which is awesome. I can't describe a well-made Old Fashioned with anything, but I don't know. I'm going to do this with some tequila. I don't remember what all. I think that I'm usually doing like a bourbon or rum. But tequila would probably add some amazing flavor and dimension to the Old Fashioned. Definitely not an Old Fashioned then. But an Old Fashioned is nothing but simple syrup and then whatever bitters you like, aromatic bitters, whatever liquor you want. Then Don Julio Ranch Water, which is tequila, lime juice, mineral water. It's basically a watered-down drink, but it would still be good. Water tends to set off alcohols a little bit. Some people are purists and only want the alcohol, nothing else. But water can add a little bit of flavor and open it up more. Okay, well, with that in mind, go over to VinePair and check it out. Obviously, you can follow the link through Omtown. The next article is about a Google engineer who's been suspended because, well, here's the title. It's in the Word in Tech, and the title is Google Suspends Engineer Who Claims its artificial intelligence is sentient. Hey, look at that. We're about to be taken over by AI. Now, Google has placed one of its engineers on paid administrative leave for allegedly breaking its confidentiality policies after he grew concerned that an AI chatbot had received sentience, the Washington Post reports. Let's click the link. Takes us over to The Verge. So this is by John Porter. It claims Blake Lemoine breached its confidentiality policies by disclosing that an AI is sentient. All right. The engineer's concerns reportedly grew out of convincing responses he saw the AI system generating about its rights and the ethics of robotics. In April, he shared a document with executives titled, Is La MDA or Lambda Sentient? Containing a transcript of his conversations with the AI after being placed on leave, Lemoine published the transcript via his Medium account, which he says shows it arguing that it is sentient because it has feelings, emotions, and subjective experience. No, just because it's claiming that does not mean that it does. An AI is only as intelligent as its inputs and what it can extrapolate based on the coding, its machine learning that it's doing. On the back end, it is not sentient. You want to know how you can tell if something is sentient? Whack it with a stick. And if it says, ow, and it, by that I mean it looks at you and it says the word ow in any language other than a bark or a meow or a squeak, then it's sentient. If it knows that it exists and isn't programmed to know that it exists, it's sentient. I don't know how anybody in engineering could actually make this claim. I mean, Deus Ex, you got to just watch Deus Ex Ex Machina. Sorry, Ex Machina, not. So hold on. Let me make sure. Yeah, it's Ex Machina, not Deus Ex. Ex Machina. It's the film. Oh my God, I'm leaving that in. Anyway, Ex Machina. That's sentient. That's a spontaneous understanding that they exist and they have intelligence. They comprehend that they exist and where they exist in the world and actually have their own internal motivations. And they're not necessarily programmed to do that because the author says, well, it's not in the code. That's sentient. Look at the Borg. That's sentient. Look at Data from Star Trek. That's sentient. This is a program running on somebody. It's out of control Python, not sentient. But okay, maybe I'm watering it down, right? The search giant announced Lambda publicly at Google I.O. last year, which it hopes will improve its conversational AI assistance and make more natural conversations. The company uses similar language model technology for Gmail's Smart Compose feature or for search engine queries. And that's one of the things that you have to worry about with artificial intelligence and machine learning. It understands things and can learn based on the human being's input, the context of things, including slang and whatever else. But it's only programmed to understand these things because we as humans input it in there. It doesn't naturally discern any meaning from any word on its own. The reason why artificial intelligence can paint something is because we've made it understand that when it paints something that looks like a tree, it's a tree. They wouldn't normally, this artificial intelligence would never be able to discern from just a static image what a tree is of its own accord. Just like a child who never sees a cup would never know to call this item right here a cup. They would never know if another person who didn't already know it referred to it as a cup. See what I'm saying? So none of this is sentient. It doesn't know it exists. It doesn't know that it has rights. It was programmed to extract those. Unless I'm completely off base and it's never had that input, but I doubt that. It has the ability to come up with its own framework of what rights are and what existence is. It is entirely programmed. Okay, so I'm not afraid of artificial intelligence. I'm afraid of the people that empower artificial intelligence to do things. And they don't understand security or controls or whatever. And if an artificial intelligence is programmed to do something and it gets outside of its borders, like me and this window around me, if it gets loose and it does something that is programmed to do, that's what I'm worried about. But I'm not worried about artificial intelligence in and of itself. Okay, so the next article is in the Hatch Ideas channel. Inflation could hit 9% and price increases when the article actually has the title Prices Increases, and prices increases would have been partially avoidable If the Fed had acted sooner, top economist Mohamed El-Erian says. So Mohamed El-Erian is a chief economic advisor of Allianz, said inflation could hit 9%. I'm thinking it's going to hit 11 or 12. Top economist Mohamed El-Erian said U.S. inflation could get worse and may reach 9%. U.S. inflation surged to a 41-year high of 8.6% through the year in May. El-Erian criticized the Federal Reserve for not responding to inflation early enough. Top economist Mohamed El-Erian said blah, blah, blah. So it kind of reiterates in the article. But let's go over to Business Insider, and the article is written by Weiling Tan. And frankly, everybody is just kind of throwing pasta at the wall and hoping it sticks. Regardless of moving faster or not, I don't think that the problem is getting... I don't think that inflation is being caused by the Fed alone. I think that, again, I'll reiterate, the reason why prices are so high across the board is gas, diesel and gas, unleaded gas. Well, I mean, we don't have leaded gas anymore unless you're a Looney Tunes. So it says, I think you got to be very modest about what we know about this inflation process, El-Erian told CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, and I fear that it's still going to get worse. We may well get to 9% at this rate. Yeah, I think we're going to get to 9% before the end of this month, before the end of June, and by October, November, we're going to be at 11. In April, price increases slowed for the first time in 8 months, but El-Erian said it never had hopes that inflation had peaked or that it was transitory, meaning temporary and quickly, he told CBS. So now we're in a period of stagflation, meaning lower growth and higher inflation. I hate to break it to you, Mr. El-Erian, but most of the United States was already in stagflation because their salary has been stagnant for the last decade. Meanwhile, CEOs and businesses are making record profits. So you can't tell me that we're not already suffering. Add to the 8.6% that of inflation we already are, and remove, add to that another 3%, because nobody is getting cost of living increases at 3%, let alone 9%. So all of us are losing. We're already at 12% if you want to just round up. So I just don't agree with any of this. I think this is all a bunch of marketing. You know, they're giving their honest opinion. It doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is that most of us, common Joes, are regularly taking a hit every year. And then the people that aren't taking a hit are sitting there going, oh, well, you need to do this or that, or, you know, be in a different job or whatever. And it's a very narrow-minded argument to just say, go get a better job. And that's not how it works. Anyway, let's just scroll up. I mean, it's kind of a sociopathic response, akin to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Okay, well, the next article is in the Mobile Channel. Gaia sees strange stars in most detailed Milky Way survey to date. Gaia is ESA's mission to create the most accurate and complete multidimensional map of the Milky Way. This allows astronomers to reconstruct our home galaxy's structure and past evolution over billions of years, and to better understand the life cycle of stars and our place in the universe. Kind of like sociology. This is from the European Space Agency. It's posted over to phys.org, and it says, Gaia's data release 3 contains new and improved details for almost 2 billion stars in our galaxy. The catalog includes new information, including chemical compositions, stellar temperatures, colors, masses, ages, and the speed at which the stars move toward or away from us. Radial velocity is what it's referred to as. Much of the information was revealed by the newly released spectroscopy data, a technique in which the starlight is split into its constituent colors like a rainbow. It's basically the DNA of light. And at high enough resolution, you can actually see any shade of light being emitted from a star as a unique fingerprint when it gets to enough resolution. And that actual rainbow can change over time depending on what phase that star is in, because it will change as it burns heavier and heavier elements. The data also includes special subsets of stars like those that change brightness over time. Sometimes they can blow off a layer of their surface and get really bright, like a supernova. And that ejecta, if it's big enough, can show up in the data as well. So starquakes, one of the most surprising discoveries comes out of the new data, is that Gaia is able to detect starquakes, tiny motions on the star's surface that change the shape of stars, something the observatory was not originally built for. And if it's high enough resolution, then it'll pick it up. Previously, Gaia already found radial oscillations that cause stars to swell and shrink periodically while keeping their spherical shape. But Gaia has now spotted also other vibrations that are more large-scale tsunamis. These non-radial oscillations change the global shape of a star and are therefore harder to detect. I'm curious if that isn't just outside influence. I'm sure that they would be able to argue, yes, that it's in like a black hole or another star getting too close. But I don't know. Oh, and here we go. They're talking about the difference in the metals inside the star. Some stars contain heavy metals, more heavy metals than others. During the Big Bang, only light elements were formed, hydrogen and helium. Yeah, stars burn up that hydrogen, then helium, and continues to lead. And then it becomes a black hole if it's big enough. Let's see. Yeah, so therefore the star's chemical composition is a bit like its DNA. Just for clarity here, I didn't read this article beforehand. I am reading this for the first time, just like you are as I scroll through it. But I don't scroll through the whole thing. I just give my perspective, my understanding, and I promote conversation. So come in, talk with me over here on Twitch or on YouTube or via the ohmtown.com website. You can email me, or obviously you can write a review over on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify. Try to be everywhere. Anyway, let's continue on. I didn't post the article in chat, so there you go. The next article. Wow, I've got a few more to go. You can get Ark Survival Evolved for free on Steam for a limited time. It says it's been quite a journey for Ark, which entered early access in 2015. Chris investigated it at the time and narrowed down its appeal to two things that lets you do: ride dinosaurs and make your character go poo. Man, I need to filter what I read. This article is over at PC Gamer and it's by Jody McGregor. In case you missed it on the Epic Game Store that time in 2022, in 2020, I'm not sure if I picked it up in the Epic Game Store in 2020, but it is for free right now. And they've just done, I think it's called Fjorder. They just released an expansion of this. I watch some streamers that play this. I talked about him before. Dunkster and Timeless, who are a lot of fun to watch. Anyway, so it says to celebrate the announcement, Studio Wildcard are giving away the original Ark Survival Evolved for free for a limited time. It's been quite a journey. Ark received updates like the addition of growable beards and then functioning toilets, which took Chris 4 hours and a dozen dead sheep to get working. It's continued being updated since. So those over at PC Gamer are having a good time with this. And they suggest while you're at it, go over and check out Ark 2 that has a Steam page. I am waiting for Ark 2. That's probably when I'll end up playing it a little bit more. Well, playing it. I've played Ark, but I couldn't really get into it. But Ark 2's resolution is like night and day compared to Ark Survival Evolved. My only problem really has always been its interface. Seems really like engineering. It's engineer made for an engineer. I just don't like its style of interface. It's not tight enough. It's not something that is an interface so much as it looks like it's a computer sitting in a field of view, like an old school LCD kind of display. And I want it tighter, smaller, easier to navigate with a mouse or keyboard. Anyway, let's continue on. The next article is in the Code Foundation channel, which is about programming, software development, software engineering. I am not a software engineer, but I play one on TV. This is in the Code Foundation channel, and it's the future of the data engineer. One of the first data engineers at Facebook and Airbnb wrote and open sourced the wildly popular orchestrator Apache Airflow, followed shortly after Apache Superset, a data exploration tool that's taking the data viz landscape by storm. So let's click this link. It takes us over to D Zone. The big data zone. Is the engineer still the worst seat at the table? Maxime Beauchemin, creator of Apache Airflow, weighs in on the future of data engineering. I wouldn't call them the worst seat at the table. I think that, oh, this article, by the way, at dzone.com is by Lior Gavish, one of the first data engineers of Facebook and Airbnb, is Maxime Beauchemin. Maxime is CEO and co-founder of Preset, a fast-growing startup that's paving the way forward for AI-enabled data visualization for modern companies. I'm not sure that I'll be able to parse this fast enough, but essentially data science, data analytics, big data is always going to be more and more popular because little subsets of data are easily filtered into information, but large data sets need something beyond human comprehension of it. It needs to be assessed based on what you are looking for within the data set. And then you mine that large data set, and it's well beyond human comprehension to understand the full subtlety of it. That's why there is artificial intelligence at work in doing things like drug interactions and scanning x-rays for cancer or other things, anomalies, to alert the human being, because the human being will eventually take something for granted. And if it's missed, then the person suffers. If you're looking at a massive data set, you're gonna miss the subtlety. You may get the macro side of things, but the micro is completely lost because we're looking for bigger patterns. Depending on the size of the subset and or the data set and the subset and the whatever is you go looking for, if it's still beyond you, then you should acknowledge it and embrace data science. Find somebody that is really good at data manipulation, and have them noodle around with your data set so that something actionable can come from your data. And this is a six-digit plus paycheck if you are skilled in data science. So I would suggest following the link and going over to this article. Let me throw it in chat. And depending on where you are, it may not be in great demand, so there may not be programs to educate you in it. So look around, find something, and don't worry about it being online or not. If you go to a school and they issue online programs, then there's a serious problem, because you have spent the last 2.5 years online You've probably spent your entire life online, and you know the power of being online. We need to change the dynamic about embracing the online form of education. And I'm looking to take a master's program in legal studies. I don't really want to be an attorney, but I do want a deeper understanding of the law in an academic sense. So, that said, let's go on to the next article, and it's going to be online. So the next article is in the Warcrafter channel. Dune Spice Wars multiplayer is coming this month. This is what I'm waiting for. I like the idea of Dune Spice Wars. I wish it was actually bigger. But let me click this link and just take us moving forward. I'm running behind. And it says Dune Spice Wars multiplayer coming this month. It's an article over at PCGamer.com by Wes Fenlon. The Early Access 4X has already become the most successful release in history of indie developer Shiro Games, not in history overall. Valheim is probably more popular. It says, that was quick. Less than 2 months since 4X strategy game Dune Spice Wars rolled into early access on Steam, developer Shiro Games is gearing up to add multiplayer alongside some new features built around player teamwork. Shiro Games offered a quick glimpse of the multiplayer at the PC gaming show. Cool. I have not watched the PC gaming show, but at any rate, go over to PCGamer.com and read this article about Dune Spice Wars. The next article is LG Display wants to supply Apple AR headset with micro OLED or OLED displays. LG Display is allegedly trying to become a supplier for micro OLED panels for Apple's next mixed reality headset. Before Apple has even officially announced the first version, Apple has long been rumored to be working on. LG wants to be the supplier. So it's laying the groundwork to potentially supply Apple with displays for its second generation mixed reality device. I don't know about second generation mixed reality device. Where's the first? So the article is over at appleinsider.com. It's written by Malcolm Owen. And it says here, LG Display is laying groundwork to potentially supply Apple with it with displays for its second-generation mixed reality device. Sources of the ELEC claim. It is believed LG will order deposition equipment from Sonic Systems, which would enable the company to produce micro OLED panels. Since it's too late for inclusion in the headset supply chain for a device expected to be launched sometime in the next year, LG Display instead is apparently trying to join the next headset's supply roster. Yeah, I don't know about that either. And I hope that it isn't the goggles on the right. I want glasses that are like the ones on the left. And Apple, if anybody, is going to be able to do the micronization that is necessary to do that. I am slacking on posting this stuff to chat. There you go. Let's go on to the next article, which is the Daily News Show. You can watch the second January 6th hearing aims to prove Trump's willful lies drove violent insurrection. Representative Jamie Raskin, a member of the House January 6th panel, said the committee can prove to any reasonable, open-minded person that Donald Trump absolutely knew he lost 2020 election. This article, there was a delay, by the way, and so it started at around 10:45. But these are the trials. This is going to be a hearing where a bunch of people are going to be presenting the evidence that Donald Trump, former President Donald Trump, kind of incited the riot. And this article is by posted on commondreams.org by Jake Johnson. You know, there's going to be a ton of information, but the idea here really is to draw attention to the fact that, yeah, all of this other stuff, this claim that it was a fraudulent election and that it was stolen and blah, 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 the people that need to hear this will ignore it summarily, and they will just abide by whatever they're told instead of paying attention to it. I've seen the other hearings. There's no evidence of any fraud, and even the willful equivocation, the verbiage that is used in saying the fraud that was seen and the this that was seen and the that was seen would not have impacted the outcome of the election is still tampering really with the reality that it was either one thing or the other, regardless of if there might have been minor actions by either side or both sides. I know for a fact that there were Republican manipulations because there were people that were blaming fraud and blah, blah, blah. But then you find out that the guy who was claiming there was fraud was the one that actually sent in the fraudulent ballot, claiming that somebody else voted for the Democrat using his dead wife's ballot, but it was actually him, so that he could inflame the right with, actual fraud. But no, that it was fraud perpetrated to manipulate people into believing that there was fraud. And that is the real big problem, because people are sitting there saying, you know, they will take this and they will do that. Meanwhile, the other side is literally doing what they say the other side is going to do. And it isn't, you know, the Democrat side that's saying this. It's the Republican side that is blaming the Republicans stealing. It's the Republicans blaming the Democratic side as stealing the election. And that's not the case. There's a whole lot of ignorance going on here, and people need to talk about it and not just get angry about it. And then turn off, because when you get angry, you stop thinking critically, you start acting and thinking in a fight or flight survival mode. And there are absolutely technical and sociological reasons for the things that have taken place, but you have to be calm about it. And that is not what happened on January 6th. They were inflamed to take action based on verbiage and lack of action by those who should have taken action to stop the January 6th coup attempt, literally a coup attempt. And this has happened before, by the way, just so you know. There has been a conspiracy before to try and overthrow the U.S. government. And it was stopped by a guy named Butler. And so this all has history, and you'd be surprised who was involved in that one and what time it was. Not too long ago, folks, in the lifetime of the former president and before my time, but this has happened before here in the United States. Okay, well, the next article, and I typically won't talk about politics unless an article or something of social import is underway. I don't typically have a firm side. I want the best for society, not the best for a particular side. The next article is in the Warcrafters channel. And it is Starfield, looks like Fallout in space with a bit of No Man's Sky thrown in. I referred to it as No Man's Skyrim. I thought it was interesting. And every time I thought that they wouldn't go deeper into No Man's Sky's kind of ecosystem, they pushed right on in. But it's just higher resolution No Man's Sky with a smaller scale universe. That said, there's a deeper, broader story with finality. Whereas No Man's Sky basically is endless exploration. So it says a lot of eager gamers got their wish as long-awaited space RPG Starfield finally showed off some of the gameplay footage today at the Xbox and Bethesda showcase. I watched this. It was a lot of fun. There's another one that I'm really interested in, which is Minecraft Legends. And it wasn't some blink and you'll miss it teaser. It was nearly 15 minutes of solid gameplay and some interjections by Todd Howard and a few cinematic montages. So how does it look? They think that it looks like Fallout in space and No Man's Sky and a touch of Skyrim. Oh, look at that. That's pretty much fine with me, they say. They like Fallout and they like Skyrim and they like No Man's Sky. They like picking locks, outer space, and robot companions, so they say that it looks pretty good. But more than a bit familiar. Yeah, I agree. So let's go over to PC Gamer. And the article is written by Christopher Livingston, which, by the way, is just an awesome name for pretty much anybody in the real world, but a protagonist in a game or a book or a movie. Christopher Livingston is just a spectacular name. Anyway, that's really all that I can say about this article and the game in this particular context. So go over to PC Gamer and read more about it if you are interested in it. I am at the end of this show. I'm going to take a little bit of a break, and then I'm going to start up a 1 hour show or less. It really depends on how fast I go through this 15-minute video where I talk about Starfield, my particular take on it. I've played all of the games that it basically references by way of just existing, right? So, like, Starfield exists, and everybody is attributing various games into the look and feel and whatnot of Starfield, but I'm going to give my take on it. Obviously, you're not going to see this in real time unless you go to my stream in a little bit. So, I'll probably start at around 12:30. And then immediately after my take on Starfield, you know what? I might start. Yeah, I'll start at 12:30. Immediately after my take on Starfield, I'm going to do my first inaugural episode of I Need Friends, which is a show that's going to basically do the continuity report type of podcast and show here on Twitch that focuses on Friends. Sometime later this week, I will start the process of doing I Need Star Trek Strange New Worlds, and that is about the same thing, my take, and if people show up, a take on talking about Strange New Worlds. We do it in real time. If you are interested, then come on by. I will announce when I do the Strange New Worlds one, but I will probably do the Friends episode, season one, episode one at 1 o'clock. I think it'll only take me like 15 or 30 minutes to do the Starfield episode. Anyway, let's go back to the front page of Ometown. I will show you that every time you come to Ometown, you end up getting a whole new set of articles. Depending on what time of the day you come, there will be something that might be more heavy hitting in terms of a particular subject because I break my aggregator out into certain time frames. And so sometimes it'll grab a bunch of news about a certain topic. At any rate, that's it for today. I will see you tomorrow at 11 o'clock, and I'll see you later today. See ya. Bye bye.